Aloha, this is Catherine Cruz. Mahalo for joining us here. Hawaii Talks on The Conversation. It is Wednesday, July 22nd. Across the Pacific, communities are mourning the death of a master navigator from Micronesia. Cesario Sorolla is the son of Maupiailuk, who is credited with keeping centuries-old knowledge about wayfinding alive. We hear from fellow navigators about the loss and planned celebration of life. We learn more about compassionate release programs here in our island prisons. Hawaii is the only state without a law to regulate the process. We meet a small water bird with a distinctive face on this week's Manu Minute. And we also get to know the new face leading an iconic Irish pub in Honolulu. He envisions the space as a proving ground for new musical talent. This is The Conversation on Hawaii Public Radio. I'm Catherine Cruz. Candles lined the road from the airport in Palau this weekend to welcome home Master Navigator Cesario Sorolla. He is the son of Maupiailuk from Satawal in the Federated States of Micronesia, who is credited with keeping traditional knowledge of voyaging by the stars and seas alive. The Polynesian Voyaging Society posted an online tribute to Cesario on Monday. Cesario died in Taiwan this month, just after completing a voyage from Micronesia to Okinawa and Taiwan. We talked to Hawaii navigator Nainoa Thompson this morning. Thompson learned the skills to navigate, taught by Maupiailuk, and he has done so much to raise awareness and pride of indigenous knowledge of wayfinding. Cesario was on the Hokulea on its first voyage to Tahiti on the Voyage of Rediscovery. The two navigators were among the graduates of a Po ceremony comprised of both Hawaiians and Micronesians. Here's Nainoa explaining Po.
My understanding of Po, it's a very sacred ceremony, but it really is, in English, would be a graduation, and that you are, by your teacher, is giving you authority to sail deep on your own. And so, in Mao's mind, Po, it was letting the student go. And it was when, in his mind, that's where the real learning started, because now you're in command of a deep sea voyaging crew. Now you are carrying the legacy forward. You are there to stop extinction from generation to generation. I mean, the school of navigation on the island of Satawal in Micronesia might have been the oldest continuous maritime school in the world, thousands of years old. And so you are given this, not so much acknowledgement, but authority and responsibility, kuleana, and to carry on voyaging. And when I was asked to participate in Po, I actually told Mao when we got to the island of Satawal that I didn't want to do it because I didn't know how I could carry on something I didn't understand. You know, I don't know the language. I wasn't born and raised there. I didn't start as a young child in navigation. I don't know its genealogy. I don't know how to carry that responsibility. And he just said, I'm not asking. So that Po ceremony is very important to Mao to make sure that he has students that graduate to keep voyaging alive, because it's the school system in Micronesia. They take you off of the island and put you in residential schools on another island called Woliai. And so the navigation between the child and the master is broken. So Mao viewed this as a way to keep the navigation. And he would say, if there are no navigators no more, there will be people no more. So he understood what was at risk. And so even though I don't believe that I'm qualified, all he wanted us to do was to teach. And that was the main thing, is to keep the teaching alive. And in the end, you know, he told me that in the end that Po is the light, and the light is love. And when there's conflict, you resolve. When there's injury, you heal. you go out to sea, bring gifts back to your islands and your community, and you take care of that community, and you take care of that island. So really, it was all about malama and about caring for your people and your future. So that's what I view from him, what the purpose of the poet was.
And so what was it like being in that class with Cesario, you know, Mao's son, you know, who was also learning and trying to keep that tradition alive?
Right. I mean, it was an honor, and it was an absolute privilege, and it was clear that, and the fact that Mao graduated Micronesians with those from Hawaii was telling us, we need to know each other. We need to be, and he said this, is you are now brothers, and you are in the family of Woliang School, and you must support each other. You must take care of each other, and always stay loyal to each other in the code of navigation. And that was so that Mao was building bridges between Pacific Islanders. And do know, he graduated his second class of navigators in the following year, and they were from the Cook Islands, and they're from New Zealand. So he's constantly making these connections, and he's constantly bestowing his graduation. But it was really about kuleana, about caring for your culture, your traditions, carrying it on, stop extinction, and you do it through this loyalty of brotherhood. And so it took time to really understand that, you know, what's our purpose. But when you think about it, you know, Mao has many geniuses. That's one of them, was connecting us.
Well, you know, he was trying to protect the light, right? The keeper of the flame,
yeah.
And sharing,
yeah,
that light so that that light does not get extinguished, because that indigenous knowledge that has survived over centuries is just so important to our area,
yeah,
to our region.
Yeah, yeah. If there's no navigators, you'll be people no more.
And so the loss of Cesario this month, you know, I know I was in Guam when I heard the news, and, you know, it was just heartbreaking. And, you know, knowing that fellow navigators are mourning his loss.
Yeah. I mean, everybody is. And it was not expected. We knew he had health issues, but I didn't know it was this extreme. And when you use the word loss, well, you have Cesario, you know, sailing far. He just got through completing a voyage from Palau to Taiwan to Okinawa, and then was on his way to Guam, but there was that big typhoon that came through the area. So he went back to Palau, but that's a long voyage. It's thousands of miles. And so he was doing exactly what his father was. In order to teach navigation, you have to sail, and you have to go deep. You have to go far. And so, the youngest of the sons, and to me, the one that was really chosen by Ma to carry the light forward. You know, Cesario would be the youngest to ever sail the road Kiale Kahiki between Hawaii and Tahiti. He was 16. And he was on the escort. Mao intentionally brought him with him. Mao kept Cesario right next to his side when he sailed with us. And so he was the chosen one for sure. And he kept his promises to his father. He was going deep sea up until the very end. And he was training and teaching many. On one hand, you could, of course, you're going to consider this a loss, powerfully. But, you know, Cesario, we have to thank him for what he's done to keep what was so important for his father alive. And the future of Cesario is in his students, those that will carry on. So, yes, we are very sad. Yes, we're in mourning, but we have to always remember that he kept that alive, he carried that alive, and he gave it to younger people. The equation that Mao knew was so critical to the survival of who they are as a legacy of maybe the greatest navigators ever.
Well, we understand that in Taiwan, the indigenous people there, you know, paid tribute to him when he passed this month. And, you know, there was the tribute when his body arrived in Palau over the weekend. And I know that the family's still planning services for him. But, you know, I also know the airfares are just so high right now that I worry about the people who may want to travel there and just can't afford to.
Yeah, that's correct. I mean, it's a hard route, and it's very expensive. It's outside the means of, you know, people just being able to live like in a place like Hawaii. It's so expensive, and but what we're going to do is on the 30th of this month we're going to. We're bringing navigators together. We're building a star compass for that night on the grass where my parents live, because that's where Ma lived also, and Cesario lived. And we're going to have a Hawaii tribute to not just Cesario, but to Cesario and to Ma. And then also to Shorty Berlman, one of Ma's great students who passed away, you know, earlier this year. And the way we do it is that at around dusk on that night on July 30th, above the mountain line, the ridge line in New Valley will be the rising of three stars. And they're close together, only a few degrees apart. But the star in the center is called My Lap. And My Lap is it's Mao's most important navigation star. It defines the direction east. And right next to them are two, you know, Micronesian navigation stars that are in the star compass. And so we have dedicated the one to the north to Shorty Berlman, and we dedicated the one to the south for Cesario. So Mao's really important students are going to surround him in the heavens. We put them up in the sky, and in the heavens, we create stories, and our genealogy of navigators we begin in the heavens, so that when we teach children about those stars, we teach them a story, so those names are never forgotten, and that's going to be at a very simple, quiet ceremony, and then we will be asking a family member that is able to go to Palau to the funeral service to take a video to Cesario's wife to show that Hawaii is celebrating his life. And if she chooses to, it could be part of the funeral service. But the main issue is we let her know that we're here and we care, and we're also blessed because of our relationships to Cesario and his father.
That was Nainoa Thompson, CEO of the Polynesian Voyaging Society, who we talked to earlier this morning. We learned of Cesario's passing while we were in Guam, the day after he died. He died hours before his birthday. And while on Guam, we were able to connect with the Chamorro Navigator this past weekend. The island is still recovering from Super Typhoon Bavi. One of their large canoes was blown over on its side during the destructive winds. And while we were on the cliffside in Tuman Bay, Ron Akwaji was instructing his crew on how to safely right the vessel. Akwaji, like Thompson, is dedicated to keeping proud Pacific seafaring traditions from going extinct through his nonprofit, Ulitau.
Our mission as Ulitau is to perpetuate the Chamorro traditional seafaring construction and sailing of our ancestors' designs.
And the European navigators, explorers back in the early 1500s, 1700s, they were so impressed with the shipbuilding skills that they said that it went against everything they knew about European shipbuilding.
Correct.
That we built incredibly fast vessels.
Yes.
And so you're trying to
bring that back.
Bring it back.
We're because there's about maybe close to 120 pages of European talk on our traditional canoe. I first learned from the late Manny Sakau from Puluwat, who's right next door to Satua, where Manny is born, where Mau Pialuk was from. So they're just neighboring islands and relatives to Mau. But I learned to build first their traditional style canoe. And since then, I took off deciding to want to build our own. and figure out what it does in the ocean and what is it, why is it they say what it is. So we're trying to recreate that, but they did it thousands of years ago. We can't just do it in 10, 15 years. We got to keep trying and redesigning it.
And so the materials then that you use to recreate these vessels?
Yeah, traditionally what our ancestors used were the breadfruit, the indigenous breadfruit called daok, and the another tree that is used for medicinal is called the dogdog, which is the breadfruit tree, and daok, which is the medicinal tree that they use for medicine, for skin medicine. And those are two that we're now using to try to recreate that.
Right, because that's what they used originally.
Yes, correct.
Native trees.
Yes, but because the trees were destroyed during World War II when Americans came and they started bombing the island, canopies got very short, and now the trees are not as big as they were. So back then, sometimes it's just a dugout and it's big enough to do an open ocean with just a dugout. But now we can't find that kind of tree. So we do planking systems. So we build up with starting from the bottom, main keel, and then up to, then we build up to its height. But we don't know what the weather was like back then. I'm sure it was kind of nice. But nowadays with this, with El Nino and the weather, the typhoon, the climate change, 3 years ago, every August and every September, every April, May, and June, it was good sailing time. But 2 years passed and it's been very terrible. So, yeah.
You have to modify based on the conditions.
Now we have to build our planks a little higher with splash guards along the seats on along both sides, and then just weigh it out and find. But we've done voyaging. We've done quite a few sailing around the island. We've gone to Rota. It's not something that is that can be done. We can do it, but we're just taking it one step at a time. I'm teaching the younger generation. So now that I've got a lot of young participants and interested Chamorros that want to learn about their culture, I think it'll make things much easier for us.
And so talk about the voyage that you took up to Taiwan and Okinawa, because you were asked to go along on that voyage with Mao Piai Luksan.
Yeah, in April of 2025, actually in January of 2025, he had messaged me and asked me if I'd be willing to go with him on their first voyage ever to take to Taiwan. And it was supposed to happen, or it happened in May. And I accepted a voyage and rode with him on a voyage from the double hull canoe with the Alangani Masu that was given to Mao from Hawaii. And we sailed all the way up to Taiwan. It was 1,400 miles open ocean. We were going up with the wind, so it wasn't that bad. But coming back, and it took us 14 days to get there. Whereas coming down, it took us 31 days because we were going down against the wind.
And so this most recent voyage, though, they tried to go again.
Right. It took off again this year to go up to Taiwan, from Taiwan to Okinawa, and from Okinawa to come back down to Guam. Because I think what it was is that we're trying to recreate what our ancestors may have traveled, what route they may have taken to travel down to Guam. Some say that we came from Sulawesi, or some say we may have come from the Philippines, but it's hard to go against the wind when the wind's coming from the east. So more than likely, everything went up and then further up and then was able to come back down, going island to island, island hopping, which is much safer.
And the planned voyage to stop in Guam on the way back, that was thwarted with the super typhoon Sinlaku.
Correct, yeah, it was aborted because Sinlaku came in, and when they were in Okinawa, they decided to just take it from there straight down to Palau. So the voyage was not meant for them to come to Guam yet.
And so they were going to postpone that leg?
Yeah, that's a long leg, but I don't know. Now that's just not happening. I'm not sure if it's going to happen for a while.
Yeah, because he passed recently.
Right,
and
right.
So that you're still grieving and grappling with what that means.
Right. Yeah, it's kind of hard. We're kind of heartbroken because of his spirit that was within us during the voyage. So, all we can do is just take his knowledge and keep passing it on. That's the best.
And I know that there was some discussion about the navigators of Micronesia and the Polynesian Navigating Society. You know, there was some, in Hawaiian they say pilikia, some bad feeling that there had been maybe some appropriation, that Mao and his had shared the knowledge, and yet the Polynesian Voyaging Society wasn't always giving the navigators in Micronesia the credit. But I don't know.
Yeah.
What you think about that?
Well, you know, Polynesia, I can't fault them for what they're trying to do and trying to recreate. I can't fault them for that. But yeah, every time they, you know, if Iona Thompson always gives credit to the old man, that's always very nice to have. It's always good to know that, you know, his name is there all the time. But then Matson did the same thing. They went ahead, they're stationed in Hawaii. Matson freight forwarders, you know, put their name on, put Mao's name on there. So I think for us here, we just keep moving on. The younger generations have moved out of the old small islands and are now all throughout these areas in Guam, Saipan, or even mainland. Most navigators are pretty much gone in the smaller islands. So everyone's pretty much in this area. But yeah, maybe we just need to come together maybe one day and hold something here in Guam with Polynesians and Micronesians, and then just have a powwow and then just sit down and try to make sure that we go forward and we go forward together.
Yeah, I think there is a debt of gratitude everybody owes Mao for sharing that knowledge. Yeah. And then as each generation comes up, that we reaffirm what we're doing and try and recreate and try and understand our culture and that sense of pride.
Yeah, I was surprised because when I got back from the Palau, from Taiwan, and we were in Palau, I asked him because somebody had mentioned that they're going to be doing a po ceremony, first time to ever be done here in Guam. And I asked him, what does it take to become a po? And he just said that it was very straightforward. And he says, anybody can learn star navigation and anybody can build a canoe, but not anybody can put a community together. He says, if you can put a community together, then you have established that most powerful part of being a po is being a team player, being work with everybody, you know.
We have been hearing from Chamorro navigator Ron Akwaji, and before that, Nainoa Thompson of the Polynesian Voyaging Society. They were paying tribute to Cesario Sarvalua, son of Mau Piailug, the Micronesian explorer who is credited with ensuring that traditional wayfinding does not die by sharing it with other Pacific Islanders. Funeral services for Cesario are being planned for in Palau for next month.
Support for The Conversation comes from the HPR Local Talk Show Fund, which helps Hawaii Public Radio sustain and grow its locally produced talk shows. Mahalo to contributor Furniture Plus Design.
You're walking down a flight of stairs and feel a twinge in your knee. You think, uh-oh, did I tear something?
It's very easy to believe that pain lives exclusively in the body part that hurts. But neuroscience tells us that is not true.
Incorporating the mind into our understanding of pain, this week on Hidden Brain from NPR.
Beginning Sunday morning at 11.
Support for HPR comes from the State Office of Elections. Registered voters who haven't received their August 8th primary election mail ballot packet can contact their county elections division, elections.hawaii.gov.
This is The Conversation on statewide member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. Coming up, your backyard quiz. He rides around on a horse, he protects the arts, and hates fast food. He's got a pink cape. He is Captain Haleiwa. If you know, you know. Captain Haleiwa was an old school grassroots activist who wanted nothing more than to save the old Haleiwa Theater, a historic community cinema house here on Oahu. It was demolished in 1983 and replaced with a McDonald's. But Captain Haleiwa put up a good fight, wearing a flamboyant superhero-esque costume to raise awareness about the cause and calling every government agency he could think of to stop the project from happening. It all came to a climactic finish as Captain Haleiwa stood atop the theater, which was actively in the process of being demolished, and he was throwing burgers at cops. He was finally apprehended by a very peeved police officer who supposedly was very scared of heights and did not want to be on that roof. So, the question for today is this. Captain Haleiwa's hat was the only clue to his true identity. Can you tell us what kind of helmet it was? Call 808-941-3689 or toll-free 877-941-3689 if you know the answer. The first one to get it right gets an HPR reusable tote bag.
Support for the Backyard Quiz comes from Nereid Hawaii, which supports nonprofits providing affordable housing for families of agricultural workers and retirees, such as the Kunia Village Development Corporation. NereidHawaii.com.
This morning, we are delighted to have Ashley Mizuo join us in studio. She now covers healthcare issues in Hawaii for KFF Health News, formerly known as Kaiser Family Foundation. And she stopped by to talk about her story that took her inside a prison to learn about the state's Compassionate Release Program. Good morning.
Good morning.
It's so nice to see you again.
I'm so happy to be here. Nice to be back.
Yes. Well, you know, you went in there and, you know, you're covering some healthcare stories in underserved communities.
Right, right. And I did a story about compassionate release, which is what's granted to prisoners who are severely ill, like they have incurable cancer or they're just really unable to care for themselves. They're granted compassionate release, which is like early parole. However, they can't just, after you get compassionate release, they're not going to just release these prisoners onto the street. They need to be put in some type of long-term care or with family who will assume responsibility for them. And care homes are very reluctant to take prisoners, you know, largely due to their criminal backgrounds. And so what this means is that prisoners who have been granted compassionate release, some of them are left kind of in limbo, waiting for some type of long-term care placement, but still in prison, even though they've been granted this compassionate release. This is an issue that's not unique to Hawaii, but something that many states across the country are grappling with. So in Hawaii, sick prisoners are sent to Halawa Correctional Facility, who are very sick, and they're held in their infirmary. I went to see the conditions myself and speak with some of the prisoners who are being held in there, a few of which have been granted compassionate release, but are in that situation where they're still awaiting a long-term care placement. You know, one of them people I spoke with, his name is Christian Alameda. He was granted compassionate release in February after a stroke left, you know, most of the right side of his body paralyzed, and he's still waiting to find a long-term care placement. There are basically six cells in the infirmary, and there are really big metal doors that lock two beds in each room, a seatless metal toilet in the corner, and like a window that just looks into a concrete wall. And, you know, one of the prisoners staying at Halawa Infirmary in June that I talked to or, like, spoke with, they couldn't really walk. Many of them couldn't dress themselves. One man couldn't recall what his illness was, and another with brain cancer couldn't really coherently respond to questions. And Alameda is not the only one who's waiting, you know, for this long-term care placement. One of the people who has been waiting the longest was granted compassionate release in August of 2025. So it's almost been a year since they've been waiting for that placement.
Wow. So just no place for them to go, whether it's a hospice situation or family. You know.
Yeah. Yeah. And I say waiting the longest because, you know, the Hawaii Parole Authority actually didn't separately track those who had been receiving compassionate release from from regular parole until 2022. So the records of who has received compassionate release and are still in prison in Hawaii are kind of sparse. Corey Ranke, who's the head of the Hawaii Paroling Authority, told me that for one prisoner, he called over 100 care homes to see if they would accept this prisoner, but all of them declined, and that in his 24 career, he's never actually been able to get someone accepted into a long-term care facility without the family intervening to, you know, like call the care home or willing to take the prisoner take responsibility of the prisoner's care.
And then how does Hawaii stack up with everybody else across the country?
Yeah, so Hawaii is not unique in that this is an issue that many states are dealing with, but Hawaii is the only state in the country that doesn't have a compassionate release law on the books. So the way that compassionate release works in Hawaii is it's an internal policy within the Department of Corrections and Rehabilitation who refers prisoners to the parole authority, and then the parole authority can then grant that compassionate release. And that's what makes Hawaii a little bit more unique than other states.
Yeah. Anything else that struck you in your reporting on this issue?
Yeah. I mean, I spoke with the Hawaii Health Systems Corporation, Oahu CEO, who oversees, you know, these state-funded long-term facilities. And, you know, he said the reason that they have not been able to accept anyone who's received compassionate release is because violence, they're worried about the risk that it would pose. I would say, though, that violence in care homes, regardless of the person's criminal background, has been extensively documented. And that's one of the things that advocates bring up, is that care homes are not necessarily doing full criminal background checks on every single prisoner. I mean, on every single patient that's inside of that care home. And so they're saying, you know, just because the parole authority is the one calling doesn't necessarily mean that this person is posing a threat. They've been vetted by the parole authority to be released on compassionate release.
Is there any chance that rules could change, you know, to help improve the system?
Yeah. So, I mean, there are several states that have contracts with care home facilities to have them accept prisoners, and they get a higher Medicaid reimbursement rate. And I will say that when prisoners are kept in prison instead of being released on compassionate release, the state has to pay for all of their health care, because prisoners are not able to be enrolled in Medicaid until they're out. So that means the state is picking up the bill for these very sick patients who are still stuck in prison.
Yeah, well, hopefully, your story will, bring light to this issue, and that somehow we can make it easier or come up with some way to be compassionate.
The legislature has been trying to pass different types of bills that would address compassionate release, but so far none have actually made it over the finish line during the legislative session.
Okay. All right. Well, thank you so much for highlighting this.
Thanks.
We have been hearing from Ashley Mizuo, HBR's former government reporter, who is now the Hawaii correspondent for KFF Health News. You can find her latest story republished on our website. Head to hawaiipublicradio.org.
Support for HPR comes from Zippy's, celebrating 60 years of serving Hawaii and supporting local businesses, including collaborations spotlighting local creators. Upcoming collabs at shop.zippys.com.
This July, experience HPR's Live from the Atherton Classical Concert Series. On July 18th, violist Yuri Hughes joins pianist Jasmine Nagano for an intimate recital. Then on July 25th, vocalist Kaylin Howard and pianist Brian Bathia take the stage for an evening of classical song and piano. Get your tickets now at hprtickets.org. This event is sponsored by HMSA.
Support for The Conversation comes from the HPR Local Talk Show Fund, which helps Hawaii Public Radio sustain and grow its locally produced talk shows. Mahalo to contributor Chaminade University.
You
You're tuned to The Conversation here on Hawaii Public Radio. Have you ever seen our endemic coot? Well, it can be found in wetlands throughout the Hawaiian Islands. And despite its widespread territory, its small population numbers can make this bird hard to find. But we've got its call for you today, courtesy of the Macaulay Library at Cornell Laboratory of Ornithology. Here's University of Hawaii at Hilo's Patrick Hart with today's Manu Minute.
Ale keokeo, or Hawaiian coots, are water birds that are found on all the main Hawaiian islands except Kaho'olawe, and are endemic to Hawaii, meaning that they're found nowhere else in the world. They're also considered to be endangered, with less than 2,000 individuals left. About the size of a small duck, both male and female ale keokeo are mostly black, with white bills and a prominent bright white shield above their bill. Unlike ducks, their toes are lobed instead of webbed, which allows them to better walk on land. Hawaiian coots are mainly found in coastal wetland areas, kalo fields, and aquaculture ponds where they eat a variety of aquatic plants, shellfish, and fish. In Hawaiian mythology, ale keokeo are known for their chattiness and harsh warning cries. Ale keokeo have a really interesting nesting behavior, where they often construct floating nests out of aquatic vegetation. This allows them to avoid many introduced mammalian predators such as dogs, cats, rats, and mongoose. A recent paper from a UH Manoa graduate student showed that predicted sea level rise from global warming will cause a significant reduction in their nesting and foraging habitat. However, this could be offset and even reversed if traditional indigenous farming techniques, such as the maintenance of lo'i for kalo, are expanded into former agricultural wetlands. For Hawaii Public Radio, this is Patrick Hart from the UH Hilo Department of Biology.
Support for Manu Minute comes from Island Naturals Market and Deli on Hawaii Island, since 1998, offering local and organic foods in Hilo, Pahoa, and Kailua Kona. IslandNaturals.com.
Saturday night on The Real Deal. It's the buttery sound of the peerless alto saxophonist Johnny Hodges, best known for his many years with Duke Ellington's orchestra. Join me, Seth Marco, Saturday night from 8 to 10 on HPR 1 as we celebrate Johnny Hodges.
Support for HPR comes from Hawaii Energy's Empower program, helping small businesses with energy solutions. Learn more about this grant program at hawaiienergy.com/empower.
It's time to unmask the answer to today's backyard quiz. Earlier in today's show, we asked you about the man, the myth, the legend, Captain Haleiwa. He may not have succeeded in stopping the demolition of the historic Haleiwa Theater, but according to residents, it was sure fun to watch. And despite the drama of his last stand against the man and Ronald McDonald himself, Captain Haleiwa was charged for trespassing. He posted bail a few hours after his arrest. Unfortunately, the old Haleiwa Theater was demolished by the time he returned. But despite the rush to level the historic cinema house, it took years for the lands developer to get the permits to even build a McDonald's there. We asked if you remembered what kind of iconic hat that Captain Haleiwa wore. The answer, he wore an aviation helmet. It's tied to who Captain Haleiwa really is, which we could have asked you about, but wouldn't identifying this mystery man ruin the fun? Well, congrats to Brendan from Palolo. You got it right. Aviation helmet. That's our quiz for today. If you have an idea to share, send it to talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org.
Support for HPR comes from the State Office of Elections. Registered voters who haven't received their August 8th primary election mail ballot packet can contact their county elections division, elections.hawaii.gov.
Under new management, longtime patrons of a Honolulu dive bar were prepared to say ahui ho to the old Anna O'Brien's and hello to Tavannas at Anna's. But the local musician will be keeping the iconic name as he takes on running the nearly 60-year-old establishment. The bar first opened its doors in 1969 as Anna Bananas. That's what I remember. After 40 years in business, the Anna's name transferred into the hands of barman Bill Comerford in 2010. We spoke with Comerford earlier this week, and now musical artist Tavano has taken up the mantle as the new face of Anna's. HPR's Kevin Allen sat down with Tavano to talk about why he became the bar and musical venue's newest frontman.
I think that, you know, Bill's been running successful venues and bars here for quite some time, and I've known him since I was in my early 20s. You know, he hired me. He was one of the first people to hire me in Waikiki to play music. And I worked with him, you know, in all of his bars for 10 to 15 years. And I think I sort of made it out of that level of musician, you know, and I was able to make a little something of it. So I think him reaching out was really about him wanting to pass it to somebody that came up, you know, during his time and sort of pay it forward in that way, you know? So at first when he came to me, I was like, this is totally insane. There's no way I'd be able to do it. But the more I thought about it, I just kept thinking of how I've spent so much time talking with friends about improving the music scene here and uniting it in a way, you know? And that's been the running talk for me for so long, and realizing that this is a huge opportunity to actually do something about that, you know? It's a big undertaking. I mean, huge undertaking and a lot of responsibility, but it came my way, and I'm just one of those people that's like, okay, well, obviously this is being presented to me, and I'll never be able to look back and say, oh, what if, like, you know, I'm not that type of person, so I'm gonna take the ride, you know.
Absolutely. And, you know, I think yeah, you have so much background as a gigging musician, especially at places like Anna's, but, you know, all around town. I guess, was there some trepidation kind of shifting from being on the performing side to now what is a bit more of a, you know, a different side of the industry?
That was probably the first pause for me, was just like, will this take away from, I got a new album coming out, right? You know, we've been working on it for about a year, really excited about touring it, and some of the artists we have on it, like Taimani and Henry Capono and John Cruz and Sidney Agudong. I mean, we got some, it's a great album, and, you know, right prior to this opportunity, that was my main focus in my career. So it was like, okay, hold your horses. I mean, you know, you don't want to let that stuff slip either, right? So that was definitely some pause there. But the more I thought about it, it was just like, well, I could just put in a little more work, and it would actually be, you know, one hand washes the other is the way I see it. If I can spend a good 6 months revamping a historical music venue and have a home for myself as well, musically, I'd be able to take my performances to a level that I've never been able to do that before, because I've been in other people's stages. Mm-hmm. But I could take my performance and my show to exactly what I want it to be and curate it from the ground up. And I can do it for others as well in the community, you know, and I've never had an opportunity to do that. So as those like late nights thinking, you know, it's like, okay, well, every excuse I make to not do it, there's 10 to do it.
It's rare in life when you're given an opportunity to have exactly,
I know,
what you want, you know,
right?
Like, but it is a ton of work. I mean,
yeah,
kind of just talk to me about, you know, how much work you've been putting in. I know you've been doing some behind the scenes, you know, on your Instagram of some of the renovations upstairs and what you guys are doing with the stage. Tell me just about what that's been like.
It was a gigantic shift, man. I'm not going to act like, oh, it was super smooth. It was this huge shift. Luckily, I mean, I went from the last few years being more of a nightlife sort of getting off late, you know, of gigging and going to bed late, you know, everything late, waking up late, you know, so and starting over again, flying a lot and all this stuff. And then I'm sleeping at, you know, 10:30, 11 p.m. at night, and I'm waking up at 5:30, 6 in the morning, and I'm working all day. Sure. So it's a complete shift in dynamic, you know? And I had no idea how I was going to react to that, because I've been doing the other life for 20 years. Mm-hmm. But I've been doing it now for a solid 3 or 4 months now, and I got to say, I like it. I do. It's
you
weird.
You might have found a new calling.
I really surprised myself, honestly. I enjoy the mornings. I enjoy waking up, having peace, you know, in my house for a little while before everybody wakes up, and just like thinking about what I want my life to look like. And it's pretty amazing. And it's actually, I've written like 15 songs throughout this whole process at the same time, because I've been just making sure to be up early enough to where I can spend about 2 hours on my music before I go into the bar and or go to the club and, you know, start working on booking and start working on renovations and things like that.
And so talking about all this change, you know, change of lifestyle, change of names of the bar, mm-hmm. was there an extra feeling of weight or responsibility making changes to something as historic as Anna O'Brien?
Absolutely. I mean, you know, almost, you know, once we announced it, it was this huge onslaught of a lot of friends and family that didn't know I was working on this behind the scenes. A lot of the patrons that have been going to Anna's, and as I've been spending a lot of time there, you know, them expressing gratitude of saving the place. And that's a pretty heavy thing to hear, too, like, yeah. especially while you're in the process of trying to do so. So you're crossing your fingers that you can make it happen, you know, so that's a weight for sure. But I think it's a worthy weight. You know, it's absolutely a worthy weight, and I'm willing to carry it. And I can just do my best, you know.
And how has it been?
It's been great. Yeah, it's been great. We're honoring a lot of the booking that was existed. So that's going running until the end of July. And from August 1st, it'll be 100% curated by us now. Mm-hmm. You know, that'll be the new sort of run where tonight's our first night of our what I call the front door for artists, which is our open mic / open jam at the end. And it's the place that if you want to get into this and that you're really serious about it, you can come to and you can play. And I'll be there, and, you know, maybe not every Monday, but I'm definitely going to be there for the first month every Monday, listening to the community play music or tell jokes or do whatever it is that they do. And that's, you know, you show us what you have there. And then, you know, next thing you know, you'll be opening for one of the bigger acts, and then next thing you know, you will be the big act, you right. know. So we're trying to curate artists as well, and, you know, to me, that I really want to start giving the community a place to be, you know, mm-hmm. instead of just kind of a, you know, off the beaten path bar. My vision is turning it into a place where artists and the community can come and be inspired, and also come and share their talents, and a place for that to happen.
Right.
You know, I think Anna's has always actually represented that. Even I was hearing stories from back in the early days, it was the only place you could go that you wouldn't hear something super traditional or something you would hear in Waikiki. There'd be the rock bands that were just in their garages working stuff out. They'd all play at Anna's. You know, that was the place that they would go. And I want to not only continue that tradition, but I want to, like, really, really make it a beautiful garden of, like, just flourish, you know, really is the best way it can.
Right, yeah. I think that's something I'd always known about Anna O'Brien's. And I actually used to put on some shows over there, and it was, like, a very simple process, right? Like, you could just reach out to the bar owner or the, you know, the bar manager, and, like, you just pick a date and yep. you'd make a bill, and yep. all of a sudden you have a show, which yep. I think was kind of twofold, right? Because you had a lot of new sound, like a lot mm-hmm. of new bands who've just been in their garage all the mm-hmm. time, and, you know, now they want to play a show, and, you know, Anna's was a place you could kind of reach out to, and there was, excuse the pun, very low bar of entry.
Sure.
What is your thoughts on, I guess, legitimizing, or as you were mentioning, kind of curating, mm-hmm. You know, a little bit more to make sure that the acts are, you know, ready to go on stage?
Yeah, I think that that front door idea, you know, the Monday nights is going to be a big place for people to come, and it's funner to be able to come and show what you have. And we have full band setups for bands to come in and play us a couple songs, you know, so that's a great way right there. There's also going to just be an online, once we get the website together, that's a fun little process. No, but we'll get that together, and, you know, there's going to be submission forms. People can send their EPKs, stuff like that.
Cool.
And, you know, national touring acts can reach out as well. But, you know, I think it's nice to have a night we're dedicated. That's open door policy for everybody to come in and play. And some of the big heads of the music industry, you know, friends of mine can all either, I'm there or somebody's there to be like, this guy's awesome. This girl's awesome.
Yeah.
You know, and then boom, they have an opening spot, opening for who, what have you, right?
And we were briefly chatting before this, but you were kind of mentioning some of the acts that you're planning to bring on, and those are pretty big.
Yeah.
Those are pretty huge.
Yeah.
Names.
And so you can come in on a Monday night, blow our minds, and guess what? You're opening for Ookla, or guess what? You're opening for John Cruise. You know what I mean?
I mean,
that's sort of what we're looking to do there. And then on top of that, we're going to be cycling actual community nights where we'll have Halaus come out with their students to perform. We'll have, you know, Kailua School of Music or Kapena School of Music. I mean, these are great schools of music that are out there. And they have these great high school kids in these groups that are sounding killer, but they don't have anywhere to really to feel that they're at a venue, you know? And so we want to open that up to the community as well and have nights like that where we're allowing our room to just be open for those projects to invite their friends and family and watch them play music with lights and real sound and a green room and everything so they can experience that real feeling, you know?
And pulling our perspective out a little bit, again, you're a gigging musician, you've been in the scene a long time. Tell me just why it's so important that places like Anna's continue to be around. There's not a lot of opportunities for people, especially to just get their foot in the door.
Absolutely. I mean, I can pull it out to just my experience as a musician coming up in my early 20s and playing in coffee shops and, you know, hotel lobbies or wherever I could get work. And everybody has to go through that. Absolutely. But I think it was probably Hawaiian Brian's was giving me my first opportunity to be in a room that was a big show. You know, people were there to see me play. I was in the corner of a restaurant. It was like people came to my show. The lights were on me. And as a performer, you need to experience that in order to talk to your audience, because otherwise you're in the corner of a restaurant and you just don't want to bother people, you know, and you're playing your music and you're sort of secluded. But once you get like in front of, like, it was the same thing when I got to the Blue Note for the first time. People are staring at me in between songs. I can't just quietly go through my set and be like, I hope they like it. You know, you have to engage with them, and you become a whole nother level of performer only when you get to those stages. And there just aren't that many of them here. Before the Blue Note was here, and before Hawaiian Brian's gave me the opportunity, there was like zero opportunity for someone at my level to experience that other than at Anna's.
Sure.
You know?
Looking at this next chapter of Tavana at Anna's, Anna O'Brien's, and rest in peace that name. Yeah. Is that name gone by
now? No. So Tavana's at Anna's is upstairs.
Okay.
I'm going to make that the main showroom. Anna O'Brien's will remain downstairs. It's a beautiful pub. I'm also Irish, so I want to keep that little bit of that there.
Bill told me that.
Yeah, exactly. You can see it when my beard gets really long and I was younger, it'd be red. Uh-huh. But yeah. But yeah, you know, so I love the pub down there, and I'm going to keep it as close to it, what it is, as I can, because sure. I think it's beautiful, and there's a lot of neighborhood folks that come out and love that space so much.
And I think as we look towards that new chapter, you know, you have to address the elephant in the room. People are always scared of change, right?
Like, absolutely.
People are always going to be terrified of this aspect of this one thing that they love is now going to be another thing that mm-hmm. they could love too. Mm-hmm. But it's that transition that freaks people out. I guess what would you say to those people who are, you know, scared of the new Anna's, or they're scared of that change?
I mean, my policy so far through the last few months has been my door's open. Come talk to me about it. If something you don't like, then maybe we'll change it. Maybe we won't. Let's talk about it. My door's open. Like, I'm not over here to change anything. And I've been the patron of that bar for 30 years or more. So I've been around, like, you know, sneaking into there before I should have.
Sneaking up the back.
So I'm one of you, you know, if anything. So I'm just trying to do the best I can to preserve its legacy while watering it, you know, so that it grows into become something that I know that it could have always been, you know.
Well, thank you so much for sitting down with me.
Absolutely, Kevin. Thanks for having me, man.
That was HPR's Kevin Allen and Tavana, the new face of longtime bar Anna O'Brien's. The pub will be hosting a grand reopening party on August 21st with Henry Capono and Thunderstorm Artis headlining the bill. Find out more details on our website at hawaiipublicradio.org. Well, we're out of time, so we have to go. But up tomorrow, we plan to survey the field for the lieutenant governor's race. It comes as Governor Josh Green says major announcements are expected regarding the attorney general's probe into Sylvia Luke, who has decided not to run for re-election. We do welcome feedback. Call our TalkBack line, 808-792-8217, or email TalkBack at hawaiipublicradio.org. Did you know you can find The Conversation as a podcast? Search for it on Spotify or Apple or on our website. I'm Catherine Cruz. Join us tomorrow for more of The Conversation.